We are now ready to hear argument from petitioners in the case of Harold George Netta versus Drew O. Bacon et al.
May it please the court, please J.C. Frank will present argument for the petitioner.
May it please the court, my name is J.C. Zabronik. I represent Harold Jordan and Helen Jordan, the petitioners in this case. This is a statutory trespass to trial titled, the respondents Bacon, Drew Bacon sued Harold Jordan for 59 acres of land in Hardin County, Texas, and Harold Jordan filed a disclaimer as to all but 4.15 acres approximately. And so that cause proceeded to trial. Now, the respondent proved a short title. He proved that in 1921, Sarasan Gedry conveyed the property to Emma Jordan, and that Emma Jordan died in 1955, leaving three children, and that thereafter the three children partitioned the case, the land, which was about 160 acres, and that William Jordan got the 59 acres out of which the 4.5 acres comes. That was their chain of title, which of course obviously does not connect to the sovereignty of the soil. So the question then, of course, since Drew Bacon proved that Harold Jordan and his wife were in possession of the property in 1953 and no prior possession was proved by any of his chain, he's forced to prove title either by prior limitation or under the theory of common source, the doctrine of common source. Now, the Court of Appeals and the trial court held that they did prove a common source title in this case. However, those rulings are erroneous. Because the courts have mistaken what is traditionally required of a proof of title by common source. It's a very limited doctrine that applies in limited situations where both parties to litigation claim under one person. Therefore, it is said that since both claim under that person, neither has to go beyond that person to show title beyond that person under whom they both claim. Now, in this case, and as the authority cited in the brief says, the plaintiff has to prove some kind of a chain of title. In that chain of title must be a person or persons from whom the defendant also claims. He's got to connect the defendant's claim to that same party. And then as a third requirement, he has to prove the superiority of his title over the one that the defendant claims. If he can do that, he need not prove a title under any other method. Now, in this case, the respondents proved a short chain of title not connected to the sovereignty, but they did not show any kind of a claim on the part of the defendants from anything in that chain of title. In fact, they proved by the deposition testimony of the defendants Jordan that the Jordans had no kind of paper title to the property. They proved that the Jordans were the grandchildren, Harold Jordan was the grandchild of Emma Jordan, who got the title to it in 1921. And further, they even proved that Helen Jordan acknowledged that the grandmother owned the land as late as 1955. So therefore, they disconnected the defendants from that chain of title 100%. So they have simply failed to prove a title by common source. So therefore, having made that proof and rested, it was not necessary for the defendant to go forth with any evidence, because if the plaintiff has to win on the strength of his own title, not on the weakness of the defendants. And this the defendant did. Whenever the plaintiff had failed to make any kind of a title, the defendant also rested. Now, the Prince versus Sanders, the case which we cited in the brief, and the other cases there, all point out, and it is clear, there is not a single case where a plaintiff is claiming against a defendant who claims only a limitation title or, say, a parole gift title or some other title not associated with an instrument in writing, where the plaintiff has successfully proved a common source, because it's simply impossible. Now, in Gillum versus Temple, there is conversation about how that would be possible, but of course that was merely conversation in that opinion, is dicta. It wasn't necessary. They said that, well, if the plaintiff would have proved that the limitation claim began back here when they acquired title and that their title was superior at that time, but see, that fact wasn't in the case, and when you examine it, if that fact was in the case, it would be just like Prince versus Sanders, where it was held that that's not enough. Because it's clear that a limitation title claimant claims against the world, including that person. A common source must emanate by, through, and under someone in your chain of title, not against it. So that the majority of the cases keep that straight. But there's that Gillum versus Temple, there's that conversation there about that. But an examination, since it's not necessary to the opinion, and since it's expressly contrary to what most of the courts have held, it gives the petitioner, it gives the respondent no relief in this case. Now, the Moran versus Stanley, which is diagrammed in the application for writ of error, is another case where there's a lots of talk in that opinion, but basically it comes down to the fact that there was 4.5 acres of the plaintiff's, let's say the plaintiff's lessor's land across a road. It was not fenced by Castleberry, who owned 140 acres adjoining. Castleberry had his 148 acres fenced, but he did not have this 4.5 acres fenced. Lee, the owners of the 100 acres, were in possession of the part across the road for many, many years. The plaintiff pled limitation title in that case, in addition to common source. They proved that Lee had been in possession, so under the doctrine of constructive possession, that is, a one who owns the record title and is in possession of a portion, his possession by construction applies to the entire description in his deed, save and except what someone may have actually enclosed by fence. As they say, constructive possession will jump a road, but it won't cross a fence. And in this case, the constructive possession did apply across the road, so that the holding in Moran is really bottomed on a limitation title, and that should be straightened out, since the court is going to be riding on this. Although, you could say it also was a common source, because the plaintiff had a lease from Castleberry 1 year sooner than the defendant. Now, that lease described the 140-acre tract that Castleberry had record title to, plus it had the Mother Hubbard clause, you know, all the adjoining land that he owns, claims, or possesses. So that really, if you could say it's a common source case, because Castleberry's lease to the plaintiff actually predated the defendant's lease from Castleberry. Now, But really the case was decided on limitations. Now, the Nozier case is another example where the state acquired a piece of land, they thought, through a condemnation. But Saunders' condemnation back in 26 or 27 was never finished. So therefore, there's your classic a common source case. The plaintiff showed title under Saunders, And he showed the incomplete condemnation proceedings by the county, plus the county's deed to the state, and therefore his title was superior. Now, that's really about all that can be said about it, except I would just like to address briefly this one point. The Beaumont Court held that Emma Jordan was the common source, although I can't imagine how that could be, because they didn't connect the defendant to Emma Jordan in any way. In fact, they disconnected the defendants. But the court, both the dissenting opinion is correct on how this case should have been decided, except that they say the dissenting opinion and the majority opinion talks about the Hale versus Hale case, where they say the remedy where a plaintiff who loses a trespass to try title suffers a take-nothing judgment, and as this court observed in Hale, that is a harsh remedy. And the Beaumont court says, well, we wouldn't do it that way, and we asked the court, Supreme Court, to rethink that. Well, they forget or have overlooked, and I wanted to point out on this thing. They're talking about land titles, which is a different matter, but they shouldn't address their request to this court, because they should address it to the legislature, because Article 22.003 of the Property Code mandates that result. It says that a final judgment vests title against the party from whom the property is recovered. Now, a lot of courts, in the Hale Court, they didn't mention the statute, which was 7223, whatever the statute was before that, but that has been the law since the Republic of Texas days in 1840. And it has to be the law in land titles. It may be harsh, but the plaintiff has different choices of how much of his title to put in the issue and how to do it. And even there are a lot of ways, not a lot of ways, but a number of ways to prove a record title, even if you don't have the instruments themselves. You know, like your presumed deeds and your various, what they call exotic ways. But it's said that, as Judge Narvel wrote when he was on the Court of Appeals in Chandler against Corpus Christi, which is 272 SW 646, that in land type cases, that land is basic in our economic structure and is subject to repeated sales and transfers. The statutory action of trespass to try title plays an important role in determining the validity and marketability of lands. A judgment either for a plaintiff based upon a statutory pleading or a take-nothing judgment for a defendant in such suit should possess the quality of finality in regard to the question of title. Parties in privy should be held concluded so that a title examiner can with confidence state his title opinion from an inspection of the judgment and the statutory pleadings. That was at that time Article 7391, which is now 22.003 of the government code. Now, on the question of collateral estoppel, is simply that Article 31, respondent relies on Article 31.004A of Civil Practice and Remedies Code, but 31.004B actually governs, because the plaintiff, in this case, several years before the filing of trespass to try title, the petitioner Bacon sued the Jordans in forcible entry and detainer, had an acknowledgement of tenancy they introduced. They won in the justice court. The defendant, Jordan, appealed to the county court. The case was tried before a jury in county court, and the jury found the acknowledgement of tenancy was obtained by fraud, and therefore possession was denied Baker. And now in this case, they introduced that acknowledgement of tenancy again. The court let it in. The Beaumont court correctly held, majority held, that that was a collateral estoppel case. That issue had already been determined. However, they held that the jury should have been given that evidence to determine that fact. But of course, if collateral estoppel exists, it's a matter of law. It's not a jury issue in that sense, once it has been once litigated. However, of course, that will go out of the case. That issue is not going to be that critical in the case, because the case should be reversed and rendered in favor of the petitioners, because the plaintiffs filed the suit and simply failed to make a title. Thank you very much.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. A sues B to trespass to try title. A does not prove up his title. Are you saying that we ought to follow Hale and say A just didn't get anything because he didn't prove up his title? Or should we go ahead and say that B now has title because A didn't prove he had it?
That's right. The rule now is that B wins A's title. A has to prevail on his own title. And that, of course, is section 22.003 of the property code.
Now you say that now says that we have to vest title in B?
Yes.
And say B recovers the title?
That's right. Otherwise, you see, where would you be if a situation, we're talking about land titles, the record shows a long chain of title with maybe a defect into A, maybe nothing into B. A has sued B. A has lost. The result of that is simply nothing. That can't be, because then the title would be in abeyance. It would not be merchantable, even though that might be all that exists.
Well, suppose C out there lives in California and C claims the title, and C really is the legal owner of the title. C is not a party to the lawsuit.
Then he's not bound by it.
No, but you're saying if the court invests B with the title...
Only between A and B, though, Your Honor. Not against anyone else, not a party. A and B and anyone claiming by through or under. But you see, most of the time, Your Honor, that's going to be the title. You remember there were a lot of courthouses burned in East Texas. There's a lot of titles, record titles, that have to be established by secondary evidence. And you have a situation where simply you have to rely on judgments. There were so many titles at the turn of the century. There were a lot of suits brought by people who actually owned the land, but whose deeds were burnt and could not be found and re-recorded. And because there were people who came back and got deeds from the original grantees. I remember here about 8 years ago, I litigated title to a whole league because of that situation. But what saved us there was a lawsuit that most of the people were diligent in the first 10 or 15 years of this century. They filed suits, even though it had no record title, but yet those memories were fresh. They could prove that they had been in possession. Tax records were available, because see, there's lots of ways you can prove a record title even if you don't have the instruments. Of course, the longer away from that date you are, the harder it gets. But you see, we absolutely have to rely on those judgments. We have to be able to go back to those judgments and start our search there.
You're saying now the statute...
Statute's mandate
overrides the previous ruling in Hale.
No, sir. Hale, of course, was consistent with what I'm urging. The court simply said the court in Hale didn't mention the statute. But the statute was in effect all of that time. In Chandler versus Corpus Christi, they mentioned the statute. But in land law, it has to be that way, Your Honor, because otherwise... there would be no more, you know, lots of land would simply not be merchantable. And the title companies wouldn't insure them, therefore they couldn't borrow money on them. They couldn't sell them, finance, banks wouldn't finance, or savings loans couldn't finance it under rules and regulations. So there has to be a conclusion. But in the example you gave, there's no fear that we're going to give title to someone who doesn't own it. If there is someone else not outstanding who has a better title than either of the two parties, and he's not a party to that lawsuit, he can always come in and claim his title, unless, of course, he loses it by limitation in the meantime. But as between those two claimants, the title of the plaintiff, if he fails to make out title, has got a vest in the defendant. So as between those two, the title to that land is finally concluded.
Okay, well, what does the judgment say? That A takes nothing and B is vested with title?
No, judgment simply says A take nothing. The effect of it under the statute and the decisions is as Chandler, the title examiner can then look at that and says, statutory, trespass to trial title suit, take nothing, judgment, defendant gets the land. Or gets the title of the plaintiff, whatever it is.
Any further questions?
Thank you very much.
We are now ready to hear argument from respondents.
And please, the court, Mr. Glenn Kirby will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court. I'm Glenn Kirby from Koontz, Texas, and I represented the respondents in this case, Drew Bacon and his wife Cheryl and Jesse Jordan. The petitioner addressed very briefly the issue upon which the Court of Appeals reversed this case, reversed the trial court, and remanded the matter for trial. The facts in this case are really very simple. They've been obscured to some degree, I think, by this discussion of title. But Harold Jordan and his wife were the nephews of Jesse Jordan's husband, Bill Jordan. And they moved on the land of their grandmother in 1933. And they lived on that land until the time of trial. That was their period of possession, and their claim was titled by adverse possession. The resume for submission here contends or makes the statement that they claimed this land by inheritance, but that is not so. The plaintiff's title came by inheritance out of William, Mary Emma Jordan. The defendants, petitioners here, admitted that their claim of adverse possession came out of a period of possession that began when Mary Emma Jordan, the grandmother of the husband, owned the land. And they admitted that Mary Emma Jordan had title to the land at that time. And they admitted that they did not have a deed and had never had a deed to the land. So it puts the matter in this posture. The claimants by adverse possession were claiming under a period of possession that began when Mary Emma Jordan had record title, and they admitted she had record title.
But there's no conveyance from Mary Emma Jordan.
No, sir. She died intestate. The last record instrument that we put in was from Sarah Ann Guidry to Mary Emma Jordan in 1921.
But in order for you to prevail, don't you have to show that there was either a deed to both chains or that there was an inheritance through both chains? Not adverse possession. Adverse possession says that there was no title. They claimed it adversely.
Your Honor, the rule of common source says that we have to connect the title with theirs. And all of these cases...
But adverse possession doesn't do that, does it?
Beg your pardon?
A claim of adverse possession does not make a connection.
That's been the holding in Moran versus Stanlin. All the cases that Mr. Zebronic cited and tried to distinguish, that has been the express holding. That the common source may also exist when one party claims title by conveyance from a specific source and the other party claims by adverse possession from that same source. That's Texas litigation resume of Moran versus Stanlin.
I thought what that holding was, though, is that you can connect the possession through those people. If they claimed it adversely, and the next one claimed it adversely, and the third one claimed it adversely, you can tack those on in a chain,
and come up with a title by tacking on each of those adverse possessions. But that's not what happened in this case here.
No, that didn't happen. I think that is a law. You can tack possessions. But what happened in Moran versus Stanley was that, both claimed to one person. And one claim by adverse possession that began when that when they admitted that person had title, Singletary, I believe the name was. It's an exact point in this case. And they said that is common source. The same holding in Sade versus Noser. Mr. Zabranek again tries to distinguish this. But it says where a claim of limitation title derives from possession under prior grantees, since the source of their title emanates from that person or persons, they are a common source if the other party also claims from the same grantee.
In other words, you're saying that the Jordans claim adverse possession from Mary Emma Jordan.
They claim it adverse possession based upon a period of possession that began under Mary Emma Jordan.
Yes. In other words, they claim they took Mary Emma Jordan's title by adverse possession.
That's right.
And Mr. Bacon and Jesse Jordan say they have Mary Emma Jordan's title by record deed.
That's right. And by inheritance. There is no question now about the chain that we put in back to Mary Emma Jordan. We connected it with it.
Yeah.
I would call, of course, attention to a very old case of 1912, I believe it was. It was one of the East Texas Timber Company title cases, and there's so many of them. This is Ward versus Houston Oil. And it's not in my brief, but it's from 144 Southwest Reporter at the beginning of page 334. The question there is not really in point here. They had a common source title, but a question came up about whether the defendant could attack the title prior to that common source, and they held he could. But they discussed the reasons for the rule of common source. And they say that it does not operate as an estoppel, which was the claim made in that case, but the one is it's a rule of convenience and a practicality. If both parties acknowledge a title in the chain, the prior titles are all accumulated in that title that they both recognize. And when you go back to that situation, then you've made a prima facie, of course, under Rule 798. The rule of common source, that specific rule, is an exception to the rule that you have to prove your title back to sovereignty. And this is the case, these are the holdings consistently. There have never been a case that holds otherwise in this situation where you have one party claiming a title by possession, which is, as pointed out, requires a period of possession that must last 10 years. They pled the 5 and the 10-year statute, but by their admission and deposition, which we put into evidence, the defendant both admitted they did not have a deed which precludes the 5-year statute. So they're in there on nothing but the 10-year statute limitation. That takes 10 years, it must begin and it must end. They admitted it began. Theirs was continuous for some 32 years. This was a grandson and of the original party and a nephew of the plaintiff in this case. So this is the basis of common source, and we say that that's been established law. And you do not then reach the question of the Heidel case.
Who do you say was claiming against Mary Emma?
William Harold Jordan, the defendants in this case, the petitioners, were claiming by adverse possession against Mary Emma Jordan. And they admitted she had title. They admitted that their possession was continuous to time of trial, and that they knew she had title when they went on there. When she died, her husband, their grandfather, had title when he died in 59. Now there is another aspect of this case that the Court of Appeals dealt with, and we think that since the rule of common source is one of convenience and usefulness, and it's a rule of evidence and a rule of burden of proof, so held in word, not of estoppel, but of evidence and burden of proof. When you prove back to that common source, you made a prima facie case, and the burden shifts to the defendants to go forward. They absolutely refused to go forward. They put on no evidence at all. What happened in this case, this Maryam Jordan owned 161 acres and divided into three parts. The eastern part came down to William J. Jordan, the original plaintiff in this case, the deceased husband of Jesse, who are the grantors of the Bacons. They reserved some mineral interest, so they were warrantors and had their mineral interest, Jesse did. Now, during the pendency of this controversy, the other two portions of that deed of partition with mutual covenants of warranty now were Oscar B. Jordan, the father of the defendant Harold Jordan, and an aunt, Beatrice Jordan Grimes, who holds the western portion, is not involved here. During the pendency of this suit, Oscar Bradley Jordan, the father of the defendant Harold Jordan, died, and Harold Jordan held at time of trial by inheritance from his father 12 and a fraction acres adjoining this 4.16 acres that came out of the same chain of title. Now, that is pertinent to this degree. The case of Kane versus Roberts, which also don't believe I cited, 644 Southwest 2nd 492, holds that the purpose of 798, Rule 798, 791, 792 is to inform the defendant of what will be put into proof in the way of prima facie title so they'll know what to attack. These defendants were fully informed. They knew that, that Mary Emma Jordan owned the land. They admitted it freely. They admitted they had no deed. They're under a claim of possession, which began under Mary Emma Jordan and under all the rules, Stanlin, Nasser, the other cases cited in both our briefs. When you do have that kind of proof, you have proved common source. Having proved that, we made a prima facie case of title, and when Mr. Zemarnik rested without putting on any evidence, we're entitled to the judgment that the trial court gave us, which should now be affirmed. I'll try to address very briefly the basis of this Court of Appeals reversal. William Jordan and his wife Jessie sold to Drew Bacon and his wife, they did it on contract for deed, which is part of our chain of title, and at that period of time they went and took an acknowledgement of tenancy from Harold Jordan and his wife, who'd been living on this land since 32. That's the entire 59-acre tract was covered by that acknowledgement of tenancy. The Bacons then wanted their land and asked the Jordans to move off, and they repudiated that acknowledgement of tenancy as to this 4.16 acres, and we tried the matter in justice court where we prevailed and county court where Mrs. Urbanik prevailed. There was a submission and finding in county court that the acknowledgement of tenancy was obtained by fraud. That was a forcible entry and detainer case. In Hardin County, we have a constitutional county court with a non-lawyer judge. And of course, under Rule 746, I believe it is, it's in the brief, the rule on forcible entry and detainer. It says very specifically that the only issue that can be tried there is immediate right of possession, and that the issue of title shall not be inquired into. And Mr. Zabronik contended in motion in limine that the acknowledgement of tenancy should not be admitted. I contended in motion in limine that the finding of the trial in JP court and the county court should not be referred to or mentioned. The court sustained my motion, that part of my motion in limine, and denied Mr. Zabronik's. The Court of Appeals erred in saying that Mr. Zabronik tried to offer this in testimony and was refused the right to, or was prevented in any way from proving in trial in district court that that acknowledgement of tenancy was obtained by fraud. He simply did not do it. We say, of course, that collateral estoppel does not apply at all under the rule of 34.01, which he cited that specifically prohibits the county court rulings as being judged by estoppel or collateral estoppel in the district court. And also, under the holding in the Wilhite case, which was quoted by both parties and the Court of Appeals as to collateral estoppel, that applies when you have a finding on an essential issue, a prior finding on an essential issue by a court of competent jurisdiction. And of course, by this specific rule, the county court sitting in the forcible issue detainer suit is not a court of competent jurisdiction to adjudge any kind of a title matter. There have been a series of cases which I have cited that hold that if a county court attempts to pass on a title matter in such a case, the judgment is completely void. So therefore, you've got this mutually exclusive situation. If the county court passed on the thing, the judgment's void, and if he didn't pass on, it couldn't be collateral estoppel. Also, this court has more recently written on collateral estoppel in Bonneville versus Beach Aircraft, where they say now that, where you have said that before the doctrine of collateral estoppel can be invoked or used, it must be shown there's a three-part proof that must be made. One, that the facts ought to be litigated in the second action were fully and fairly litigated in the prior action. Two, those facts were essential to the judgment in the first action. And three, the parties were cast as adversary in the first action. The only thing that obtains here was the last, and we were adversaries there. But the issue of that acknowledgement of tenancy was not fully and fairly adjudicated in the action before a non-lawyer judge in county court in a forcible entry and detainer action. Assume just to the point that all the evidence that was introduced that led to this submission of was it fraudulent was barred by parole evidence rule. Then the county judge did not know what the parole evidence rule was. And also, it says it requires to be fully adjudicated. We are precluded from any kind of appeal out of county court. That's final because they're not trying anything but the right of possession. So, and also, of course, it was not an essential issue. So under all of those things, before the collateral estoppel rule should never have been applied in this case, and the Court of Civil Appeals erred in reversing it on that rule. Also, in the Scurlock versus Smithwick, this court in 1986 ruled on the rule of collateral estoppel. That's in the Mary Carter case. And the court held there that in the Mary Carter agreement, of course, it was applied to that, but the court held that the application of the rule of collateral estoppel should be left to the discretion of the trial court at making the determination of the fairness factors that the court had previously mentioned as to whether this was fair, and whether there had been a full and fair adjudication of the issues that sought to be barred. Of course, the fundamental defect in what the Court of Appeals did and what's here, I think in these last cases, this court, instead of talking of collateral estoppel, has used the terminology of issue preclusion. And if the petitioner is entirely right and the court should have excluded that acknowledgement of tenancy, not admitted at all, the only thing you've done is precluded a piece of evidence that is an affirmative defense on our part to the possession that they actually had. It does not establish their case, and it does not defeat our case. Therefore, the petitioners, who are defendants below, had no warrant or reason to not offer any testament and not go forward with their proof after the defendants arrested. I mean, the plaintiffs arrested. In conclusion, we say that the common source rule, which is specifically authorized by this court as a substitute going back to sovereignty, says that you have to go back to the title that both parties can trace to. We say that the cases are held in established law, and for the reason for the rule, admit all the reasons for the rule, when you take your title back to a party, and the other claimant to that title is claiming by adverse possession, and they admit that they began their period of possession on which they rely, when the person that you proved to had record title, and they admit that title, then you have proven a prima facie case of title under the rule of common source. And when Mr. Zabronik and the defendants failed to go forward, that our prima facie title prevailed. And that the trial court was absolutely right in withdrawing the case from the jury at that time and entering judgment for the petitioners on their record title. And we would ask the court to reverse the court's appeal and to affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Any questions? Thank you, Judge.
Just briefly, counsel, not in his brief nor in his presentation here, has cited this court to any case where a bare limitation claimant, someone without any kind of a record, paper, title, instrument, or court proceeding, was a defendant where the common source was held to have been proved. It was tried in Gillum, it failed. It was tried in Prince, it failed. Now those are the two times when I can say that there was a naked trespasser, you might say, one without any kind of paper title who tried to show himself under the common source, and both those cases they failed. In the case of Moran, which we discussed, there were two record chains. And in Nozier, there was also. In Nozier, there was the condemnation proceeding against Saunders, the conveyance from the county out of that, as a result of that condemnation proceedings to the state. And then, as the court has pointed out, there's where you say, once you've got a start of some kind of a title, and then tacking limitation possessions, you can do that. But there's nothing that says that you can tack a limitation possession in the first place to somewhere in that chain where it began. There is no case that holds it. Now, second place, in this record, he did not prove what kind of a claim the defendants made. It's not right that he proved we had a limitation claim. We pled 3, 5, and 10-year statute of limitations, but his evidence did not show what kind of a claim the defendants had. It could have been parole gift and not limitation at all. But all of that is an argument about the weakness of the defendant's title. He's got to prevail on the strength of his own. It's immaterial about, as at this point, what kind of a claim the defendants would have made. The question is did he prove common source? Because obviously he didn't prove any other kind of title.
Harold Jordan's deposition's introduced in evidence.
Yes, sir. The portions were introduced in evidence. They're in the record. They do not show what kind of a claim the defendants had were asserted.
They show that he admitted record title and Emma Jordan when he commenced his adverse possession.
He admitted that that Emma Jordan owned the land in 53. But it is not a statement in there that he commenced his adverse possession at that time. It is only that he was in possession. Now, in possession, recognizing the title of another, is not adverse possession.
Well, explain to me this acknowledgement of tenancy and how that's consistent with adverse possession.
All right. Of course, an acknowledgement of tenancy is not consistent with adverse possession. If you acknowledge the title of another, then that is generally in a land suit can be admitted to show that the possession was not adverse.
Isn't that the fact situation in this case?
All right, yes, sir. Yes, sir, that is the fact situation in this case. But you see, the acknowledgement of tenancy in this case did not have a quitclaim provision. In Republic National Bank of Dallas against Stetson, that was passed on by this court. But of course, it's an old rule. An acknowledgement of tenancy in that case can be introduced to prove that the possession of the claimant was not adverse.
Well,
but was subject to an agreement or acknowledgement of the record owner. But that acknowledgement of tenancy will not defeat your title, because an acknowledgement of tenancy without a quitclaim provision is not a conveyance and is not a title instrument. Now, that is gone into in detail in Republic National Bank of Dallas versus Stetson. Where is that citation? On that. So you see, in this case, but when the first, when the Bacon filed the forcible entry and detainer in the justice court, the only issue there was possession. In a trespass to title, title and possession are issues. But in forcible entry detainer, only possession was an issue. Well, to show his right of possession against the party in possession, he introduced his acknowledgement of tenancy. It is contrary to what he says, it was the entire crux of that of his forcible entry and detainer case. Well, in order to defeat that, the defendants, Jordan, had to show that the acknowledgement of tenancy was obtained by fraud and overreaching. And that was the only issue submitted to the jury in the county court. And it was knocked out. But nevertheless, you see, that acknowledgement of tenancy in this case did not have a quitclaim provision in it. Therefore, it was not a title instrument, and it will not defeat Jordan's title.
Well, but nevertheless, you're not holding openly and notoriously against the other owner. I mean, you're claiming adverse possession, are you not?
Yes. You mean in this case?
Yeah.
Well, no, sir. Actually, we were going to rely on parole gift. But we never got to that point. But the Republic National Bank of Dallas against Stetson, 390, SW2nd 257. But assuming we were claiming by limitation, Your Honor, then the acknowledgement of tenancy would be admissible to show, and the jury would weigh it to determine if our possession was adverse. But the acknowledgement of tenancy was in 75. There was a chance to prove a limitation title before 75. And the holding in Republic National Bank of Dallas against Stetson and the cases that it relies on and follows is that if you have perfected a limitation title, the acknowledgement of tenancy will not kill it unless it has a quitclaim provision. But you see, in the forcible entry and detainer, we had to prove they were trying to show right of possession. In this case, they're trying to show title and possession. And of course, the acknowledgement of tenancy, that issue had already been fully tried between the same parties. It was essential to that. It should not have been, is not admissible. But as we say, it really is immaterial, because even if it is properly admitted in their chain of title that they introduced, it is still not a proof of title in them. It's not proof of common source. And they selected to put this title in issue and to try to prove it that way, and it was not necessary. And as throughout they're simply attacking the weakness of the defendant's title.
You're saying for them to win, they got to prove conclusively that you claimed by adverse possession and got title by adverse possession. Otherwise, they couldn't win on their lawsuit.
Judge, I hadn't thought about it like that, but I suppose if you could ever make a common source against a bare limitation claimant, you certainly would have to go and show the nature of his claim. But of course, like I said, there's no cases that Prince is the case where it was tried and failed. In fact, in Prince, there was the required period of possession. But here they didn't. The record simply, the part of the testimony and deposition that they introduced in evidence in this case does not hint even what kind of a claim the Jordans were making. As far as this record's concerned, they might have had a record title from somebody else altogether. And simply, you can't prove a common source that way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. The court will now take a brief recess.
Can I include Rob?